I'm Ross Heide. As some of you know, I'm a parish pastor who retired at the end of February 1984. I'll get it together right. Actually, I got to get in the right century anyway. My wife and I are enjoying retirement, probably because I got involved in a project. And I think that before anyone retires, they should get involved in a project, which then will carry on after whatever they were doing is completed. And I resigned from a parish in Concord, California, having previously served parishes in Mercer Island, San Francisco, Berkeley, and a few general assignments in the church. But I got involved in history, as most of us do, kind of stumble on it. I was a member of the Fortress Press Board of the Lutheran Church in America. I went to a committee meeting in my old seminary, and I was there, of all things, early. So I had an hour to kill, and what do you do when you get to a seminary and have an hour to burn? Yeah, you go to the library. I decided at the library I wanted to see the diary, the personal diary, of Lutheranism's patriarch, Henry Melchior Muhlenberg. And I asked at the library desk if I could go back into the reserved book room, which was always locked. And they said, oh, there's a new archives building, a unit added to the library, and go down this hall and then down the steps, which introduced me to a regional archive center. Well, after our meeting, flying home, I began to reflect upon history and archives in the West. And since I had, in one assignment, covered the 15 Western states and knew a bit about it, I realized nowhere in the West was there a Lutheran archives. That is, organized. Most Lutheran groups had an archives which consisted of boxes in a closet somewhere, not organized, not prepared for researchers. Being a member of the seminary board, I wrote a note to the president and raised the question, is this something the seminary board should be interested in? Well, that's a fatal thing to do, because what happened? You got made chairman, and I saw Bob Rorby, the president of the board, said he wanted to clear the agenda and move on. So he said, Ross, I appoint you a chairman of a study committee. Report back later what you find. Well, the result of that study is summarized in a little folder that we have copies of here, and afterwards you can pick up one of them. It's a history of the first 10 years of the Lutheran History Center. Now, I know I'm supposed to be talking about oral history, but I have to fit oral history into a perspective. And I'm using this approach to get this matter of Lutheran history within the wider umbrella of what it hasn't done in the West. So, we did the obvious thing. We called together the archivists of the West and had our first conference. We're so appreciative of the encouragement that came from that and the papers and lectures that we arranged to have prepared, one of them on the first Lutheran ministry in the Pacific area. Do any of you know where it was? I'll give you an ice cream cone if you can tell me.
Camino Island.
Where and when? Yes?
Camino Island Lutheran is celebrating its 100th anniversary.
That's right. That's in the Washington state. But the Brush Prairie, I think, was the first in the state. The first in the whole Pacific was New Archangel, Sitka, Alaska, under the Russians. And the pastor arrived there on May 12, 1840. So last Saturday night, they had a dinner at Sheldon Jackson College and celebrated their 150th anniversary. Now, we had a talk on that ministry, and then we had a very stimulating lecture by a young woman, Sarah Sharp, from the Bancroft Library, who gave a really introductory talk on oral history and reminded us that very often the ungathered history is between the ears in the memories of older people. And so that started the Archivists of the West to gathering oral history. Now, if a whole body like the Lutherans have not done their homework and haven't cared for their archives, they are really in a complex and unorganized situation. I would liken it to the situation they found in Alaska about the time they are preparing for statehood. The National Endowment for the Humanities gave a major grant for a conference up in Anchorage. Really, they had two of them in two consecutive years. And the historians were gathered to kind of evaluate what was to be done if the history of Alaska was to be gathered. And since it's a very logical parallel between a region and a communion like any single denomination, you might find interesting the summary that was given by Don Elgood, who was the director of the University of Washington Press at that time. He suggested that there were some things that had to be done if you wanted to gather the history of a group. One of them is, first, find out what's been written. Develop a bibliography. And that means that you're going to come across some works in languages other than English. And up in the north, that meant the Russian Orthodox documents, some of which are at their center at their seminary in Sitka, in Kodiak, Alaska. The next thing he said, the third thing is get some biographies. Because, as wasn't it Carlyle said, that history is often an institution's history, is sort of the lengthened shadow of one person. Now up here at Holden, we have the living example of that in West, and this delightful little paperback history, West Preeb's Holden story. I picked up a copy of it because I wanted it to be within the material of our Lutheran History Center, which will be kept at the Regional Archive Center in Berkeley at Seminary. Now, Wes is one of those persistent fellows, as you know from the history. Three times he wrote to the Howell Sound Mining Company and said, I think you should give it to the Lutherans. And first letter came back, it's 100,000. The second letter came back, it's still 100,000. The third letter came back, we'd like to talk to somebody from Lutheran Bible Institute. And without Wes Preeb's three letters, you and I wouldn't be here today, because it takes the kind of blind, trusting faith in one person or a little handful of people before anything is going to happen. You have to know a Pastor Carlstrom story before you know the story of Compass Mission, Compass Center. Most colleges and institutions have their story too. So biographies is a very fundamental approach. Then there has to be written some textbooks. And it was an interesting encouragement by this historian. He said, get some written, even if they're not totally accurate and even if they have gaps. They will bring together certain information that has not been written so far. And so they'll make a contribution. They can be refined and polished later in subsequent books. But get some textbooks written, surveys, and overviews. He also pointed out there should be some books are probably out of print that are valuable, and they may need to be reprinted. Now, these principles that I found in reading the Alaska Review for the years of 1967-68, those points made by those historians and some others, which was really touched upon many facets of history, we found stimulating to us as Lutherans as we approached our task. And so it was that we began to dig in and gather, and we realized that our very imperative step was to develop more funds for archives, then looking at the small conferences, districts, and synods. We started to move toward the time of the union and merging of the American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church in America. We began to work toward two regional archive centers in the Northwest and in the Southwest. And today, I'm happy to report that at Pacific Lutheran University, in the third floor, their new third floor of their library, in one corner is a splendid space for the regional archives of Lutheranism of the Northwest. We have a beginning of a regional archive center down at the seminary in Berkeley, the lower level part of it in what was the library stack area. Now these are the background things. Now when you've been a parish pastor with an interest in history and you're starting to work with archives, you have to go back and touch base with the other groups involved. And on my trips back east, I would work in a visit to an archives. I went down to Washington and visited the National Archives. Some of you know, for many years, our country had no National Archives. It was kept, the materials were kept with the Library of Congress, and then they established the new archives. I visited the archives, and I had the interesting experience of being taken through their laboratory down in the lower part of that building where they repair damaged manuscripts and try to care for those that are in poor shape and need attention. And the director of that took me through, made a whole circuit of that place and showed me what they're doing. And that was helpful. I visited the Presbyterian Archives, which is very close to Independence Hall in Philadelphia. The Baptist Archives out at Valley Forge, and then a number of regional archives. You're probably aware that there is an association of American archivists called the Society of American Archivists. Every year they have a convention. I now have attended three of them. I've gotten a great deal of their literature, a tremendous assist from them, because they have been producing documents to help archivists in their work. Because a lot of people coming in this have not had formal training as an archivist. There are two tracks for the gathering and the care of materials, librarians and archivists. And for a long time, they kind of thought they were alike, but they are very different. And they're very different for a basic reason. Librarians take care of materials by topics, by authors perhaps. And so you go into a library, you go in and you say, where are your history books? Where are your travel books? And so we go in and make our search through topics. And that's the way libraries are together. But the others are by materials, and there is a very important rule, word, which comes out of the French. And it means that you keep them by who organized them or who produced them. For example, if you have a congregation archives, you put all the women's material together and you never mix it up with the youth materials. And you keep it separate from the church council records or the vacation Bible school. You always in an archives, and this was new to me, you keep them organized by who produced them. And then, of course, in that format, you keep them chronological. So, in gathering material from the Society of American Archivists, we archivists, many of us retired pastors that had been lassoed to do this work, you know, because we're willing to do it, because we're interested in the materials, we've began to learn that this is the manner in which it has to be done. There is in California a Society of California Archivists, and they have annual conventions. And little groups of them around the state meet periodically for encouragement and mutual support and lectures that are prepared and given. So these things are helpful to have, and I have been enriched by this opportunity to come into this. Now, we decided that the archivists of the West, looking at Lutheran history, and that we are way behind in what very few books written on Lutheran history in the West. We had to set some basic goals. And we started with our pastoral perspective, that one of our first goals was to see that every congregation of the Lutheran Church had an archive committee that was officially designated to gather and organize their records. To that end, we have conducted and will conduct more workshops for congregational archive committees. And that's where we are now. Secondly, each synod should have an archives. And then there should be the regional archives, and we've now have two, as you know. How many of you have been related or have been on the board of an agency of the Lutheran Church out here, a home for the elderly, or a student ministry, or any of those activities? Social service, okay? Now, we found that too few of those institutions and agencies have prepared a history of their ministry. So we're nudging them and encouraging them to do that. Institutions and agencies, and that even means schools. Now, Pacific Lutheran University, in a centennial year, just released their centennial history that was written by Phil Nordquist. And that's a milestone for them. And they put that together. And I was talking to Wes Preeb about what's been done about this place in its history, and to Bill Dirks, who has been working with the archival record. An institution begins, and there's that flowering of interest, but not always are the records very carefully kept together. And then there are different leaders, and leaders leave on an institution the imprint of their personality, their character, their disposition, and their interests. And it even flavors the whole program of it. The whole environment and concern for the earth is the result of some of the leaders in this place. And so an institution needs to keep updating their history and doing it periodically and summarizing. And that's a very basic thing. The pastor who's at Billings and the archivist for the Montana Synod completed a book called The Lutheran Church in Montana. Hasn't been published. The Montana Historical Society is interested in publishing it, but they're dragging their feet, and there are two other histories in line ahead of that one. So the Lutheran History Center may decide to publish that as the first history of the Western states. We want one for each state. And then, of course, this whole matter of leaders and biographies. Now, that leads us, of course, into the whole field of oral history. When you want to write a person's history, the very fact that you want to write it means that it's an unwritten story. There's another problem with history of leaders. They're usually busy and moving so fast that that's you know, they're into this and into that, and they gather this move, and then that doesn't work, and they try another one. They gather a group, and then they make a breakthrough. And so they are working with a team of people. And so you have to gather their material, and that often means you've got to, they're still living, you've got to find them an interview, and that leads us into this whole thing of oral history. Oral history is probably mushrooming in our country as no other discipline. It has flowered since way back in, I think it was 1947, that Alan Nevin really began this whole program. And he was a pioneer. He taught at Columbia, and he realized that this was an opportunity to use this technique. And one of the first graduate students, one of the early PhDs from Columbia University, a man by the name of Bancroft, Frederick Bancroft, left $1.5 million to the University of Columbia for work within the whole field of history. And Alan Nevins got involved in this. A modest grant at first was just $3,000. But he began not with tape recorders, they weren't there then. But he got a student with shorthand, and he had the student taking it down while he interviewed one of the early leaders of the whole community, George McEnany. And then as they were transcribing those notes, he learned of the wire recorder. And so they began to use that. Did any of you ever have a wire recorder? Did you have the problem of snarls like I did?
Yes.
When those things didn't stop right, those wires got intertwined, and it was an unholy mess. But then when tape recorders came out, we all jumped on those. And so a year later, they began to use tape recorders. Now, biographies were the most logical use for oral histories. They also began to move into other projects on a general topic. And I think you might find interesting to see that the first, after autobiographies, they first did a project on broadcast pioneers. Who were the early pioneers in broadcasting? The announcers, and they did those. The second one was for the Ford Archives in Dearborn, Michigan. You remember what Henry Ford said about history? In the middle of his very active years, he was asked by someone about history, and he snorted and said, "History is bunk." He wanted no time for it. He was too busy turning out Fords. Have any color you want as long as it's black. Started, of course, the assembly line, and then he raised salaries. Was it $5 a day he paid, which was big money then. But then in his move into the nostalgic years, he became very sentimental about the farm where he grew up. And he even had that whole thing bought up there to that new historical development he made. And he wanted to bring back mementos and historical things. And if you've been through that now, you can go through it and you can see washing machines from the very first on down the line. And all appliances, he did all this. But he brought, I think, his own farm and even brought the soil and set the buildings up. He brought Thomas Edison's shop there. And he sent people out to collect historic memorabilia. And he said, he gave him a blank check. He said, if you go in a place and you find they've got some things that'll fit in our things, don't bother buying them one by one. Go to the owner and find out how he wants, how much he wants for the whole thing. Buy the whole store. And he moved it to Dearborn and he sorted it out. So Henry Ford was an anomaly, from a harsh critic to a strong supporter. And so they wanted to have an archives with and interviews of all of those that had worked with him. They interviewed 434 persons who had been a part of the Ford Empire. The third big project was about oil prospecting, wildcat oil prospecting in Texas. And then in the time they began to develop a network of oral historians. In the Bancroft Library in the University of California, they have the Oral History Office, and they have done very helpful things. Now, I think you better be alerted to the fact that there are the critics of this. Barbara Tushman, who's a historian that many of you may know of, she was suspicious about it, and in a lecture that she gave to the oral historians, she said, "Oral historians gather trash and trivia with all the discrimination of a vacuum cleaner." Now, that's probably in some situations true. But when you are mining ore, you go through an awful lot of ore to get the metal you're searching for. And you may dig in oral history and you may get some key sections and the rest may be routine. But that just goes with the territory. Now, how valuable is oral history? Well, today it's one of the richest sources of historical research. And the most fascinating story to me in this book that I brought with me called Oral History, an Interdisciplinary Anthology. Mm-hmm. I love the little section about what's called the Foxfire Book. Any of you know this? Well, it's new to you as it was to me, and I'd sure like to read just a few of the things from it, and this is going to be a delightful time. I think what happened to this young teacher who went down into the Appalachians is a classic. He talks, Elliot Wigginton tells about going down in 1966. I had finished 5 years at Cornell. I had an A.B. in English and a master's in teaching. And I thought I was a big deal, a force to be reckoned with. So I went to Georgia, I took a job in a 240 pupil Rabin Gap Nakoche school where I taught 9th and 10th grade English, geography, and had about 10 other side responsibles. It's right in the Appalachians, God's country, so they say here, and I'll go along with that. About 6 weeks later, I surveyed the wreckage. My lectern, that's a protective device a teacher cowers behind while giving a lecture nobody's listening to. It was scorched from the time Tommy Green tried to set it on fire with his lighter during class. Charles Hemsley had already broken off the blade of his Barlow knife in the floorboards. Every desk was decorated with graffiti. My box of yellow chalk was gone, and so were the thumbtacks that had held up the chart of a Globe Theater. The 9 water pistols I had confiscated that afternoon had been reconfiscated from under my very nose. And it was with a deep sigh that as I launched one of several paper airplanes within easy reach, I began to ponder greener pastures. Either that or start all over. The answer was obvious. If I were to finish out the year honorably, it would be necessary to reassert my authority. No teenager was going to push me around. Besides, my course was too important. First offense would be an X in the gradebook. Second, a paddling. Third, to the principal. Fourth, out of the class for 2 weeks. It frightens me to think how close I came to making another stupid mistake. First, I had bored them unmercifully. Now I was about to impose a welcome punishment. 2 weeks out of that class would have been more pleasure than pain. Those who cannot remember the past not only relive it, they tend to impose it, mistakes and all, on others. My own high school, monumentally boring lectures and texts all forgotten, punishments and regulations and slights that only filled a reservoir of bitterness, and 3 blessed teachers who let me make things, helped me make them, and praised the results. Lucky it took only a few rewards to keep me going. How many students were denied even those few scraps of self-esteem from anyone other than their peers? And then he goes on to tell him, the next day I walk into the class and I said, how would you like to throw away the text and start a magazine? And that's how Foxfire began. From the beginning, the idea was to involve everyone. It hasn't always worked, but we try. We decided to print 1 issue put together by all of us as a class and during class time. If that issue did what I hoped it would do for my ailing class, we might try to make it a regular thing. But for the time being, 1 issue only. The contents. There were lots of possibilities. Many older people in this area, for example, still plant today by the signs of the zodiac and the stages of the moon. I had heard them mention it, but I didn't know what it meant. Rather than interrupt the conversation to find out, I figured I'd get my students to tell me. They'd probably know, since it was mostly their parents and grandparents who were doing it. But my kids didn't really know what it was either. And soon they were as curious as I was. Why not find out and turn the information into an article? So they went home and talked. Talked to their own relatives, some of them for the first time. From those conversations came superstitions, old home remedies, weather signs, a story about a hog hunt, a taped interview with a retired sheriff about the time the local bank was robbed, and directions for plantings by the signs. It was looking good. Another possibility was poetry. Many of my students hated this stuff. I suspect one of the reasons is they were forced to read pages of sentimental greeting card verse before they ever got to high school. In any case, working with poetry from an editor's point of view might be one way to overcome an already deeply rooted bias, and they were willing to try, so we added poetry too. Some was from our school and some from notably bad students in an effort to give them a boost they were hungry for. Some of it was from students in other schools in the state. Some was even from practicing poets. So we said in the first issue, we hoped that they would remember their own beginnings and their own battle to be recognized and not be too proud to provide us with examples to follow, pieces we could aspire to in our work. A tiny organism that glows in the dark and is frequently seen in the shaded coves of these mountains. And money? The school could provide no support at all. Any financial obligations would be my problem, not theirs. Looking back, I can see what a blessing in disguise that was. It meant the magazine had to sell, and that literally forced us to emphasize folklore rather than poetry. For magazines devoted to verse almost never survive very long. It meant the kids had to find the money for the first issue themselves, and it made them more determined to see the magazine go than anything I could have said. So they hit the streets after school. Any donor, no matter how small his gift, would be listed in the issue, and he would receive a free copy signed by all the kids. They collected $450. The local printer said that that would be enough to print 600 copies, photo offset. So we printed 600, sold out in a week, and printed 600 more. Each time we flopped, we got up a little stronger. Now, in this county, there exists a magazine that has subscribers in all 50 states and a dozen foreign countries. It has been written about in magazines like Saturday Review, New Republic, National Geographic School Bulletin, Scholastic Scope, and Whole Earth Catalog. It received 2 grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities, one of them for $10,000. But most important, it is run by high school students. Students who are going on to college knowing they can be forces for constructive change. Knowing that they can act responsibly and effectively rather than always being acted upon. Daily, our grandparents are moving out of our lives, taking with them irreparably the kind of information contained in this book. They are taking it not because they want to, but because they think we don't care. And it isn't happening just in Appalachia. I think, for example, of numerous Indian reservations, black cultures near the southern coast, Ozark Mountain communities, and 100 others. The big problem, of course, is that since these grandparents were primarily an oral civilization, information being passed through the generations by word of mouth and demonstration, little of it is written down. When they're gone, the magnificent hunting tales, the ghost stories that kept 1,000 children sleepless, the intricate tricks of self-sufficiency acquired through years of trial and error, the eloquent and haunting stories of suffering and sharing and building and healing and planting and harvesting, all of these go with them. And what a loss. And then in the end he says, is the subject English ignored in the process? Hardly. In fact, the opposite is true. English, in its simplest definition, is communication. Reaching out, touching people with words, sounds, and visual images. We are in the business of improving students' prowess in these areas. In their work with photography, which must tell the story with as much impact and clarity as the words, text, which must be grammatically correct except in the use of pure dialect from tapes they transcribe, layout, makeup, correspondence, art and cover design, to say nothing of related skills like fundraising, typing, retailing, advertising, speaking at conferences and public meetings. They learn more about English than any other curriculum I could devise. And so, he says, the kid who scorched my lectern had been trying to tell me something. He and his classmates, through their boredom and restlessness, were sending out distress signals. Signals that I perilously came close to ignoring. The answer to student boredom and restlessness is not stricter penalties, innumerable suspensions, and bathroom monitors. It's the arrogant way we tend to enforce all these rules. Until we can inspire rather than babysit, we're in big trouble. Don't believe me, just watch and see what happens. We think drugs and turnover rates and dropouts are a problem now. We haven't seen anything yet. Foxfire obviously isn't the whole answer, but maybe it's a tiny part of it. If this book is worth anything at all, it's because every piece of it was put together and handled and squeezed and shaped and touched by teenagers. And it's been a long time since I found a paper airplane under my desk. Now, what'd you learn about that, about oral history from that article by Alec Wiggin? Write things down. Where did they get their material?
Parents and grandparents.
Have any of you in the last months reflected with sorrow that you didn't ask your grandparents some questions? I see a lot of hands.
Even my own father.
Right. Yeah. Now that's where oral history comes in as a tool. I want you to help me now. Let's list some places where we could use oral history effectively and save some material that otherwise might be lost. Let's just go down now and you help me. Where could you imagine that oral history would be effective? In any given year, where would you find it fruitful?
In the school.
In the schools. Where in the schools?
Music programs.
I beg your pardon, what?
Music programs.
All right. Now we're really talking about a wide use of it, and that's good because we often focus too much. School music. You're thinking here of recording it, all right? Besides cassette, what's possible now?
Video.
That's right. And that we'll add this up here just to let them know that we're in this generation. What else could you record and save things from being lost?
Well, I think the grandparents speaking to their grandchildren.
Okay. You mean like grandparents telling stories, huh? Mm-hmm.
And how it was in my family when they came here from Norway and that and what they went through.
And I'm going to put down children. All right, that's great. What else? One of you said my father.
Yes.
I think we ought to remember that parents. I don't know who I was talking to, you know, in our own kids, and I mentioned something, and a son said, I didn't know you did that, Dad. Mm-hmm. I think they think we must be born full grown or something, and we don't go through all these dumb chapters that they're going through. All right? Parents. What else?
Well, you use it for community history.
Yes. Okay. You're thinking now of bringing them in not only on personal, but community. Okay.
Aunts and uncles.
Okay, I'm going to put down parents and other, I'll just put in relatives.
I think teachers at school too.
All right. Teachers at school. When do,
Medical history too.
Medical history, that's right. They're really into that very, very specifically, aren't they? I'm fishing for places where you can gather this. I'm a
courthouse.
All right, now that's records though. If it's there, it's records. And we're talking now about spoken.
Letters.
Well, now let's go over here and let's put down here. I didn't read one little section from this that I perhaps should, and it talks about the great need for oral history, and it talks about the thing that you and I, you know, we don't even think of it. It's the fact that today people don't write as many letters as they used to. If you want to know why, look at your phone bill. You pick up the phone, you buy one of those so many hours a week, and so you call, and you even have set times you telephone. Or your kids phone you, and you send them a check. And, we've all done that, and that's great. But the point is, there's no written record of it. Nevins, this great pioneer in oral history, says, the telephone, the automobile, the airliner, by enabling people to contact one another as readily as the expression suggests, that was displacing the confidential letters of old, thereby robbing historians of incalculable treasure. So you do not have as much written literature. I would like to tell you there's one place that you may find your personal history, and you may be as surprised as I was. Mother passed on, Dad passed on. I was the one that brought his papers to our garage. Our garage has no room for an automobile. And my wife has ordered me not to die until I clean out all my papers and organize them. But in Dad's file, I found a folder that had every letter I had written. And I had written Mother and Dad almost weekly. And any key thing in our life or family or children, I would share because I knew how much it meant to them. Well, you can imagine how I felt. I had forgotten a lot of it. I'd forgotten much of it, but there it was. So I'm suggesting to you, don't you dare let anybody toss out those boxes until you look through them. You may be very surprised what you find in them. And you may be happy. Report cards, newspaper stories,
diaries,
that's right. So these things. All right, now where do you get?
Autograph books.
Beg pardon?
Autograph books.
Autograph books, they have little messages in it too. All right, when do families get together?
Reunions.
Funerals.
All right, now you're really?
Right.
Weddings.
Holidays.
Yep, holidays.
Now, some people I know, when they make a videotape of a wedding, they engage a cameraman. Please don't give this to one of the family to do.
Right.
You'll save $50, but you'll tie that person up. They won't be reacting, interacting. But you set up a place, first place, if you have a meal, that's when the spontaneous little jovial anecdotes come out. And many of them are priceless. There is a kind of a buildup of spirit when they're together. And if you can let that be videotaped, at least cassette, have a cassette recorder. Get those down. And then after the wedding is over at the reception, if you go back to the house, there's a period of time when you can get the people to come together and then let a few specific questions get them going. But that's a time they will tell. When Mother had died and our service was over, we came back to our house and our son and one of our daughters was there and some of the other relatives, and we ate together. And you know what happened? All those stories that you brought back, and do you remember when? And all the things, and as we walked out to the car, our son said, "Dad, now I know why you go to family meals after funerals. That's where you learn family history." But even I didn't have sense enough to record it that day. You should put a recorder with a mic nearby and just get the whole thing. You can buy recorders at Radio Shack, a microphone with a long cord, and it can sit on the table right in the middle, and it's in all direction, and it'll pick up the whole conversation. And then you've got it. And then if you've got somebody that is willing to take that and transcribe it, you've got a marvelous section for a history. Yes?
My brother, who's been dead for some time, and my parents too, cornered my parents one time.
Yeah?
And they, I suppose, were a little older than I am. And he sat them down and he said, "I want you, Mother, to tell me where you were born, when you were born, who your parents were, who your grandparents were, what you did."
Right.
And he put that all on tape.
Wonderful.
On the other side, he interviewed my father.
Marvelous.
And if he hadn't done that, we wouldn't have that story.
Good for you. I bet you count that a treasure of your family.
Really.
Well, my role up here is to kind of stimulate you, to encourage you to do this, and we'll move on in the next sections into ways in which you can personally produce simple little booklets inexpensively using new techniques. And we'll move from this idea of awareness, and especially today we looked at oral history, we'll move on to some of the other ways. I told you that I had brought, just for your information, this is a 10-year history of this group that we are with. We're volunteers. We have to raise all our own money, and for a long time we didn't have any, and I paid postage and all out of my pocket, but now we've gotten a few gifts and all, and I'll show you our first book next time we meet. But if you want to pick up one of those, just read it at your leisure, take it home with you, and it'll show you what the archivists of the West are doing, trying to see that this history isn't lost. Thank you so much for going. I think it's time to take a break.
No, some of us, about 17 of us, aren't going to be here tomorrow.
Okay.
Is there any way we could get an outline?
Well, if you want to buy one cassette, you can make an arrangement and get the next lectures on tape cassette.
Okay.
That would be the easiest way to do it, I think. Ask in the cassette office just as you leave. Well, I thank you for coming.
Where is the cassette office?
Right through that door and on your right. Good.